there has been talk about a bill that would every once every 2 years do that, make it just focus on the budget completely. Do you think that'll pass?
As a prediction, the governor has expressed support for it. The Senate leadership has expressed support for it. The House has been more skeptical. This is an interesting one. The first I heard of this in Oklahoma's context was from then Lieutenant Governor Jerry Askins when she ran for governor. She was a strong supporter of a biannual budget. I think there are some advantages to it. I do think that it might allow for more focused, intensive attention to the budget. However, I know that many people are skeptical about things will really change. We have a budget process that is decided by very few people at the end of session behind closed doors, and I don't know whether leadership and appropriations chairs are going to give up that authority. And to say that they're only going to look at substantive bills every 2 years, we live in a rapidly changing world, and I don't know whether it is the best policy to say that we're only going to have every second year an opportunity for legislators to look at changes in corrections reform, look at electoral reform, look at healthcare reforms. There's a lot to do, and so I think you can make the argument either way.
Jonathan, if we were to do substantive bills just once every other year, it might cut down on the big government bills that have been coming down. Or do you think it would just, instead of 2,600, we'd have 5,200 every year?
No, I mean, as long as they kept the same bill limits at the House, that would help. That's the only thing that would keep it down. I share David's viewpoint. He and I both try really hard. You know, when you've been around government that long, it's bipartisan. Once you get control and you get to be one of the three in the room, it's very difficult to get a majority of that three of the room, force all the others to, essentially unilaterally disarm. So I'm not super hopeful that we're going to see the legislature essentially vote to limit the way that they can bring self-gratification and political wins to themselves.
Any other questions? Yes, right over here.
So to that point, it's somewhat easy for constituents to call or email their representatives to say, I care about this particular issue, whether it's teacher pay or fill in the blank with whatever you care about, but it's not only an unsexy headline, but it is hard to even begin a conversation, which I feel like is like very limiting on what we can say or how we can even better elect officials who we desire to speak about the budget. So how would you suggest, both of you, us changing the conversation from the hoodie bill to the budget?
It's extremely difficult. Objectively, a $600 million budget shortfall should be the number one issue on everybody's priority list this year. But when I'm at the Capitol talking to advocates, they all have particular interests, whether it is a licensing bill or a bill that affects a particular hospital or a substantive education bill having to do with curriculum. In some ways, the budget is so big that it's really hard to wrap your arms around it. We spend a lot of time trying to do education on the budget. We put together a state budget summit. We give a lot of presentations. We have resources on our website. But it is complicated, and most people don't really see themselves as experts on the budget. And really, the whole reason that we were created as a policy organization that focuses on fiscal issues from a perspective of low-income Oklahomans is because low-income folks don't have lobbyists to represent them in the budget committee meetings and at the tax committee meetings. It's really hard. And I don't think there's an easy answer other than, we try to make the information as accessible and as understandable as possible, but it's a tough slog.
Jonathan?
That's a good question, but that's a tough question. Like you said, there's multiple varied interests at the Capitol on any given day, on any given issue. And like you said, it's not just the hoodie bill. This isn't the first time. You know, when I was in the Henry administration, we were talking about lottery and gaming saving education and going to generate lots of funding, and that it would solve its education funding issues. So, you know, this isn't new. Again, this isn't new. It doesn't matter what party it is. And that's why I question, you know, as society, the notion or thinking that government can provide much of the solutions that we have. Most people don't realize it, but we actually advocated for salary increases for social workers at the Department of Human Services. Our budget included making the recommendations for the Pinnacle Plan. But the problem is, for lawmakers, they don't feel like they get any credit for taking care of existing programs. Because you only get credit if you create up something new or you expand something new. And so that's one of the tough things. You know, unless voters can somehow amass in a way and create some sort of electoral responsibility, barring some gigantic cataclysmic, you know, I mean, you're gonna have to see revenues decline by $2 to $3 billion before you would see, you know, any real serious focus on the budgeting. The evidence of that is the governor said that they could essentially solve this budget problem by raiding revolving funds again and using the rainy day fund.
We should mention about the sexy bills, the hoodie bill, and we've got several others. Do you think some of the blame goes to the if it bleeds, it leads media that is not looking at the budget, but looking at these fly-by-night bills?
I might say that on both sides on the national level. You know, it's probably like refreshing or a good thing. If it weren't for the media, you know, highlighting the hoodie bill, you know, who knows, we probably would have gotten stuck with it. If I could tell Griffin Communications and Fox 25 and Channel 4, hey, you guys need to let your reporters do more talks about the budget, yes. And then they would say, yeah, and then we probably couldn't fund our TV station if we did that because no one would watch.
I think there is a strong media dynamic. It's also a very strong partisan dynamic that whenever somebody says something contentious and outrageous on the other side, it generates a ton of Facebook posts, but it also generates a ton of, you know, the parties will immediately put out an email saying, did you hear what so-and-so said about this subject? Send us $20. When somebody says we need to improve revenue forecasting so we can have a better understanding, I mean, you're already asleep now. Nobody sends out an email to say that the pro tem has put forward a bill to improve budget forecasting or to provide a better way to evaluate existing tax credits. So there's a lot of things that are pushing us. What I try to tell folks who do get discouraged, certainly among progressives who get discouraged by some of the more extreme things that are said at the legislature, some of the more outrageous bills, is that very often, you know, the people who are speaking into a megaphone are not the ones who wield power. That if you actually have power at the legislature, you don't need to put out a press release every time. You don't have to do extreme things. And I think for the most part, if you look at the pro tem and the speaker and the secretary of finance and the governor on most issues, they are pretty pragmatic, moderate people who are trying to get things done. But what you hear time after time are the most outlandish bills out of the 2,300 that get filed.
And right over here.
Yes, this strikes me as a very courteous confrontation of two different political philosophies. I wonder if each of you, if there's time for each of you to take just a couple minutes or whatever to explain respectively what each of you believes is the true scope of government. You know, where should the state government be involved and where not?
Go ahead.
Sure. I think that if we look at our vision of Oklahoma as a state that provides good schools, good health, safe communities, good paying jobs, that all of our mutual goals depend in part on a strong and effective public sector. Not alone, but in conjunction with businesses and nonprofits and foundations and faith communities and families. But if we're going to have a well-educated, well-trained workforce, we need good public schools. If we're going to have a healthy community, we need a health safety net that provides health insurance for some and public health for others. If we're going to protect our most fragile families, we need the Department of Human Services and Office of Juvenile Affairs and Department of Mental Health that are helping the neediest. Obviously, if we're going to have safe communities, we need a police force and a correction system. That if we're going to have infrastructure to get our goods to market, that we're going to need publicly funded roads and bridges and other public infrastructure. That if we're going to have a competitive level playing field in business, we need adequate regulation. So in all these areas where we depend, where we're looking to be a healthy, prosperous, safe state, that it depends on part on having strong, effective government, and that in many areas, Oklahoma has fallen behind and has severely underfunded our public institutions.
Jonathan.
You know, our perspective at OCPA, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, is that we envision seeing Oklahoma as the freest state in the nation that is empowering its culture to be able to meet a lot of its own challenges. And that means having a safety net for the truly needy. But it also means being willing to reflect upon the existing government programs and say, are they working? And being willing to admit when they're not working and reform them. It means that when you're talking about education, the Constitution says that lawmakers will provide for an educated public, a system of public education. That doesn't necessarily mean that that system of public education has to happen in a public school building. It means being able to embrace the ideas like we have in higher education in Oklahoma. In higher education in Oklahoma, our OLAP program, the OLAP scholarship program, it provides scholarships to students in Oklahoma regardless of whether or not it's a private or public college. When it comes to transportation, I doubt any of us want to be in a position where every single road and bridge is constructed and repaired by state government workers. Our state couldn't afford to support that size of employment in that area. So I think that that's part of the challenge. It means being able to put aside assumptions that either party may have and look at things in an honest perspective to say, are they working? And if they're not working, why aren't they working? And what can we do to actually help people be in a better position? Oklahoma trails the national average for the makeup of the private sector as a share of the total income in an economy. Nationally, that number is 68%. In Oklahoma, it's around 63%. So if we want to provide the best opportunity for Oklahoma citizens, is the answer always by expanding government, or is it by actually empowering people in the long term so that they can find a job in the private sector?
But there's five military bases in this state, and I mean that those are some of your biggest employers: Tinker, Vance, Fort Sill. These are seemingly some of your largest employers in Oklahoma. That's got to be a large share of that public employers.
Right, but that doesn't make it better. To think that our economy is heavily dependent on the U.S. government fighting wars and having a very large military force. I don't know that that bodes well for my kids or your kids' future. We're going to see a necessary drawdown in BRAC. So as we see the federal government get its budget better situated, either on its own or by the law of numbers for Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security on the federal budget, what can we do to promote a more diverse economy in Oklahoma?
And right over here.
Yeah, first I want to say thank you both. I've really enjoyed hearing your perspectives. I'm relatively new to Oklahoma, and this is my first year to really pay close attention to local politics. It seems to me, I want to take a step back maybe, and this might be a silly question, but given that this seems to be a continuing trend that government budgets fall short time and time again, is there a pragmatic reason why I should care about the budget? I understand for me, if I don't have money, I can't buy food. But I've heard budget shortfalls used to justify lots of different policies, and the government seems to keep working year after year, and society doesn't grind to a halt when we have a deficit. So is there something different about a state budget from my own budget, and why should I care about a deficit?
Actually, very good question.
That is a good question. I think the extent to which you're affected by state and local public services will depend on what you do and what your family circumstances are. I think that if you have a child in a public school, you are very attentive to what's going on in schools, how many students are in your child's class, what classes they're able to take, what services they're able to receive. I think that if you're attending higher education, you're very attentive to what the tuition charges are, and how much state funding goes there. I think if you have a family member who is in a nursing home, you're very attentive to the inspections and regulation of nursing homes. If you have a family member with developmental disabilities, the fact that we have 7,000 families on a waiting list for services for a home and community-based waiver, and that they have been on a waiting list for 9 years since January 2006 would affect you directly. So there's certainly people, I think as you move up the income spectrum, you may feel less dependent, but I think you still depend on public safety and transportation and education. If you're a business and you're looking to hire, you are very concerned about the quality of the education system. So I don't think any of us really live in isolation from state and local government. And I think that overall in a series of indicators, if you look at, you know, college percentage of the population with a college degree, if you look at those without health insurance, if you look at public health measures, we are seeing the impact of underinvestment in public services.
Jonathan.
You know, I mean, obviously I would have to disagree with some of those statements. You ask a really good question. I've wondered the same thing over the last, since I've been associated with working with government in 2003. I hear the word shortfalls. I'm told that government is going to end and that it's not going to be able to fund core services. And they either appropriate more than they did during the prior year, or by the time you include the state revenues, they spent more than they did in the prior year. And the public should ask a really good question. Really, are we really in a crisis if we're going to have state agencies spend close to $40 million in SWAG? Really, hospitals are suffering when they're advertising on sporting events? Career Tech's budget's really devastated, but it's sponsoring halftime sponsorships for basketball teams. So I think those are the kinds of questions that people are asking, and I think that's why you don't see lots of, you know, weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth by the public, because they hear it all the time from government that it doesn't have enough money. In the record revenue years in 2009, state agencies that coming out of that next year requested nearly $1 billion in increases. This year they requested nearly $2 billion in increases and nearly 2,000 more staff. To quote the Tahlequah superintendent, she stated, "There will never be enough funding for education. It will always need more money." So I think that's some of the rationale that we deal with and that you have to wade through, and why sometimes people go to their sides. Because often government, since it's taking its money from people, it doesn't really have to answer the question that people have to, which is they generate the income. And they do actually have to balance their budgets.
One more question here.
Thank you all for coming. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Short two-part question. First part, how much of the state's budget is tied directly to the price of oil? And second part, what percentage of the state budget is this $600 million deficit? And what percentage of that state budget is the rainy day fund? So we can tie some of these percentages together. Thank you.
Well, we actually, fortunately, we have a fact sheet that you can pick up on the way out at the front table that looks at some of these numbers. There's a number of numbers that are being asked for. State appropriations this past year were $7.2 billion, so $600 million is about 7% of that. The Rainy Day Fund has little over $530 million in it. There are various rules as to how you can tap into the Rainy Day Fund. The legislature could appropriate up to about 5/8 of the Rainy Day Fund, which would be about $320 million next year. I don't think anyone expects them to appropriate the full amount that they could, because we don't know how bad this is going to get. And we would certainly say that we should be looking at relying on some of the Rainy Day Fund for next year's budget to try to minimize that shortfall, but not the full $300+ million that you could. In terms of the impact of falling oil prices, with the revised certification, they're assuming that next year's energy prices are going to be about $50 per barrel for oil and about $2.80 per MCF for natural gas. I think that's a fairly realistic assumption. It could go lower, it could go higher. But interestingly, between December and February, when the certification fell by $300 million, most of that decrease actually comes from lower income tax, personal income tax revenues, not from less in oil and gas severance tax revenues. So, you know, the forecasters are paying attention to what's going on. Baker Hughes and Helmerich and other oil companies that are announcing layoffs. We are really feeling it already. We just don't know how long it's going to go and how deep it's going to get.
Jonathan?
You know, so you asked what the total amount was that shortfall is that they're saying, the $600 million. Well, when you compare it just to appropriations, you have to remember that the legislature isn't appropriating most of the tax collections it brings in. When you compare that $600 million to the total state spending, according to the state's comprehensive annual financial report, which is what bond advisor or what bond rating agencies are going to use, and what people that are going to purchase Oklahoma bonds would look at, that number is 3.4%. The challenge is, and I think that's why we have to ask the question, does doubling down on more government spending going to work? The reason why we're going to see a decline is that oil and gas jobs since the recession made up 2/3 of the job growth in Oklahoma. When you look at the private sector in Oklahoma, oil and gas jobs make up anywhere between 20% and 25%, depending on that year. So if you're government and you want to spend more money, is the best way to be able to get more money to spend by trying to extract it from that finite pie of already tax-producing people? That hasn't worked for states like California and Illinois and others that are seeing massive out-migration because of their tax policies. And that's why I suggest we have to have a really serious conversation about how we diversify Oklahoma's economy and make it attractive, regardless of the business sector that someone may be interested in.
We're coming to the end here, but I do want to actually ask you about off-the-top funds. You kind of touched on it there, about the idea of the right now roads and bridges gets a certain amount that's never even appropriated. OLAP is one of the things that gets certain. And there has been talk by the governor about maybe looking into these. Do you think there's a possibility the government will have the wherewithal to get rid of some of those off-the-top funds? I mean, that's roads, that's education. Do you think they'll be able to do something like that?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the thing that people forget is that there's a lot of pre-dedicated revenues. There's a host of the list. It's nearly $3 billion of the roughly $10 billion in taxes and fees that the state's bringing in. So it's not just that. It's the teacher's retirement system. The legislature has increased over the last 10 years from $171 million to one of the worst funded pension systems in the country, on its head, on its way to insolvency, to over $305 million a year in dedicated revenues. That's dedicated income tax, sales tax, and corporate income taxes. Those are all, a lot of those areas are areas of government that people consider core functions. The reason that they've been dedicated is because of a lack of belief in both lawmakers and the public that if lawmakers had their hand on that entire pie every year, that they would actually fund some of those core areas adequately. And I think that's one of the questions that the legislature is gonna have to have, is would it have the self-control to pay its pension obligations? California and Illinois don't. They don't have off-the-top monies dedicated in such a way like Oklahoma does, and they're shortchanging their government employees.
David, do you think there's gonna be any change there?
We are hearing more about off-the-top allocations. The problem is that, as Jonathan said, the money that is going off the top is going to roads and education and pensions and higher education scholarships. And ultimately, the question is not whether we change the way that we deal with a shrinking pie, but how do we sustain and grow our revenue base? And the problem, while off-the-top allocations is part of it, it has been a decade of repeated tax cuts and proliferation of tax breaks. This year, $400 million, a little more than $400 million that is not being collected due to the preferential 1% tax rate on horizontal drilling. That's why we are facing a fiscal gap that is much worse than it should be. So we really have to look at how to close those tax breaks, expand our tax base, and then we can figure out what is the best allocation of revenue.
Let me give you guys a couple of minutes to make a couple of minutes of closing statements. David, Jonathan, we started with you last time. David, why don't we start with you?
Well, I appreciate again this opportunity and hope that folks here tonight and listeners will go to okpolicy.org and sign up for our email updates. I think if there is any benefit to the budget shortfall that we're facing is that it does point to the seriousness of the situation that we're in. And just want to reiterate that while a substantial portion of the problems that we face are tied to a slowing economy, are tied to low energy prices and to layoffs in the energy sector and others that depend on oil and gas production, that we do have a structural budget deficit, that we face chronic shortfalls, that in good times and in bad, that we are not generating the tax dollars that we need to take care of our schools, to fund our public safety, to provide support for families with children with developmental disabilities, to provide treatment for those with mental illness. These are core functions that are needed to be a prosperous state, to provide opportunity for all Oklahomans. So I hope that this does lead us to some serious look at how do we reform our revenue system, how do we reform our budget system that will have benefits over the long term.
Jonathan.
You know, I would close with making sure that we remember that the state, even in a sluggish economy last year, according to the state's annual comprehensive financial report, set a record for state spending and revenues again, that if we just implemented 10 state budget recommendations, if we enacted state employee health insurance reform, we could save $95 million and increase the take-home pay for state government workers and decrease the inefficient spending of healthcare costs. We could reform our Medicaid system as both blue and red states have done and make Medicaid work better for patients and improve health outcomes and lower taxpayer costs. We could stop spending on not funding on non-core agencies like the Oklahoma Horse Racing Commission or spending on the Oklahoma Insurance Department, who has a fee structure and a revenue structure that can adequately fund itself. We would stop and end earmarks, including rodeos, roping contests, local fairs, local aquariums, local festivals, and more at $8 million. We would get out of the workers' compensation business and sell CompSource and move to a system which most states have, where they actually have a residual market. We would get out of the business of owning utilities and operating utilities like we do with the Grand River Dam Authority. Those two things alone could save the state over $550 million. We would enact real performance review plans for government employees, where government employees would be incentivized and could get rewarded instead of waiting upon the political whims, which is what's happened to them over the last two decades, whether Republicans or Democrats were in control for hiring. That would save over $41 million a year, and it would increase the salaries of many government employees. We could stop doing things like spending money on duplicative conservation district offices. We could eliminate funding for attempts at space travel, which has cost taxpayers over $8 million over the last 8 years. And if we eliminated swag and the various memberships by legislators, the governor's office, and a host of others, we could redirect $39.8 million a year. There are real answers to deal with the funding challenges that the state has. It's just a matter of whether or not lawmakers have the fortitude to do it.
There we go. And please give a hand to Jonathan Small with the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs and David Blatt of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. Thank you both very much for coming. And thank you to Picasso's for hosting us again. We've really enjoyed being here. We do want to also mention some KOSU people who are here. Rachel Hubbard is here. We've got Ken Boyd. Is Crystal here? Chris is gone. And we also want to welcome our new education reporter. Emily Wendler is our new education reporter. You'll be hearing stories from her. We're so glad to have her along with all these great people that make KOSU special. We know that one of the reasons that KOSU is special is because of people like you and being a part of KOSU. It is public radio, and so we really depend on you being a part of it. So please listen, and of course, we've got our membership drive coming up soon, so something to think about as well, coming up very soon. Again, thank you to Picasso's, and thank you very much for coming. Have a great night.